It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron will be here in a few minutes to answer your plant questions. But we're going to start the hour in the world of insects. Entomology professor and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's always a pleasure.
And we're going to talk about beneficial insects today. And I do think that when most people think about beneficial insects, there's a group that springs to mind first. So let's just talk briefly about them. And they're the pollinators. We talk a lot about them these days.
We do. And it's because they are suffering declines. And we are cognizant of the fact that about one third of the food we eat, especially the variety of fruits and vegetables that we eat, requires the services of somebody, and that's usually an insect, to carry pollen from the male part of the flower to the female part of the flower, which in many plants would not happen if insects such as honeybees, bumblebees, solitary bees were not there. So pollination is important and pollinators are important.
Well, and you mentioned honeybees, which of course are the pollinators that we hear the most about these days. Let's talk a little bit more about the other native pollinators, because honeybees are not the only ones doing that work.
No, but they are the workhorse of pollination services because they are so easy to box up and move from place to place. Whereas the solitary bees, the things like sweat bees, longhorned bees, those smaller, often brightly colored bees may live in a hole in the ground or they may live in a hollow stem. And there's no huge conglomeration of them in one place. It's one female, hence the term solitary bee. There's one female who built a nest and provisioned it and has a few dozen offspring in one area. It's not like there's 50,000 of them in a box waiting to be taken somewhere else. So because of the movability of honeybees, they are the ones we think of most often, but the native bees are out there. We've done surveys and found up to 50 species of native bees on vegetable farms where we have surveyed. The Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge is running a survey of bees on their area, and they found over 100 species of bees that are out there pollinating flowers that we don't even think about.
Or we do think about when we see them and think,
You know, it's interesting. When you say the word sweat bee to an audience, there's kind of this murmur of, oh, yeah, I know what you mean. And people don't seem to be as afraid of them. Somehow the metallic green sweat bees, those little bees that are about a quarter inch long, you saw them resting on your arm when you were hot and sweaty working in the garden. They didn't sting you as much as, oh, they slightly irritated your skin. They just don't seem to generate the aversion of larger bees. When you mentioned bumblebees, people sort of start backing away from you. So it's interesting. We have different feelings about different bees.
Well, let's talk about another class of beneficial insects, which also elicit a lot of different feelings. And those are the natural enemies that we can bring into an environment or are already there that kill other insects that cause a lot of trouble.
Exactly. And the one that comes to mind for most people would be something like the bald-faced hornet or the paper wasp that nests under the eaves of your house in this little umbrella, upside-down umbrella-like comb that's up there in the protected corner of your porch or your house. Those wasps that we think of as a stinging nuisance are also gathering caterpillars from your garden plants. They bring the caterpillars back to that nest area where they chop caterpillars and other insects up into little pieces of sushi that they feed to their offspring. So they are beneficial in that they are catching caterpillars and other insects out of the garden and using that to raise their offspring to increase their numbers.
Which is a hard thing to remember when you see the nest of wasps.
You know, it's always the same story when people call and say, I've got a colony of yellow jackets in my foundation. I've got a colony of yellow jackets in the ground out by my garden. If we could just ignore them and stay away from them, if we could live and let live from a distance, we would save those predators that are doing us some benefit. But when stinging insects are in an area where we just can't tolerate them because of the traffic that goes by there, then we do have to dispatch them, but we should do so with reluctance, remembering that they were providing a benefit.
Let's talk about parasitic wasps and other insects that live inside, the kinds of insects that you don't want around. It's a creepy form of biological control.
And I think the mental image that helps a lot of people understand what we're talking about when we're talking about parasitoids or parasites is think of the movie Aliens with Sigourney Weaver, that here was something that lived inside the body of a host and eventually broke out of the body of the host and then was free living for a period. And that's what these tiny wasps and flies are doing to other insects. Many people have seen tomato hornworms in their garden with have these little white bumps on the back. And those little white bumps are the cocoons of wasp larvae that have eaten out the innards of the caterpillar. So it is kind of a gruesome way to go if you think about this alien being is going to be inside the body of the insect, inside the body of the insect larva, whatever it is, eating out the insides, but eventually is going to break out and be free living. Now, that process of breaking out is why we use the term parasitoid. These are like parasites, but parasites usually stay inside the body all the time, like the ringworms in your cats and the flatworms in your pigs and so forth. They stay inside all the time. These parasitoids, these small wasps and flies, emerge to live outside, live free, mate, reproduce in another host.
So how easy is it to harness that kind of power? I know that there are organic farmers, organic gardeners who put these kinds of insects purposely in their garden, in their farmland, to try to harness that power. How effective is that?
Out in the real world where the parasitoids could disperse to the sun on a moment's notice, where they could fly to the next acreage, they could fly to the next woodland, the benefit is probably minimal. It's not hurting anything to add lady beetles to the environment. It's not hurting anything to add praying mantids or parasitoids. But the benefit is going to be pretty limited because of the mobility of these predators and parasitoids. Now, in the greenhouse, in the conservatory, where you can release tens of thousands of these every week, you can keep the scale insect population under control. You can keep the mealybug population down to a dull roar. So in an enclosed environment where you can constantly reintroduce more parasitoids, it does work. So it's not foolish to add them to your environment, but just don't have a lot of high expectations, especially if you already have a pest problem. These parasitoids are good at limiting the growth of a population rather than controlling it after the explosion has already occurred.
Let's talk about another group of beneficial insects, and this one also is met with a lot of disgust, but boy, they do a lot of good work for us, and those are the scavengers.
Scavengers and recyclers. The insect world was into reduce, reuse, and recycle long before it was cool. That insects have always been chewing up dead plants. They've been chewing up dead animals. When roadkill happens alongside the highway, immediately flesh flies and blowflies will find that, and that becomes a food resource for the offspring of the fly, and that begins the breakdown, the decomposition of what otherwise could accumulate on the landscape. So this breakdown of organic matter, this recycling of nutrients, is a valuable service that insects are doing for us. And they're doing it for free. Nobody has to pay them to go out and clean up roadkill. They'll take care of it for us.
They even seem to be enjoying it. I mean, I know you can't anthropomorphize, but
let's see. Does a fly maggot appreciate being in the a body of a dead raccoon? Well, everybody has to be somewhere. And sure, they are surviving because they're able to utilize that decaying animal as their food source, and there's not a lot of other things that can work on it at that stage. Now, once it's down to bones and leather and hair, there are other scavengers that can come along, but that first process of decomposition really depends on maggots, and we should thank them for it.
Well, I think that needs to be stated even more strongly, because really, if it weren't for the maggots doing that work, where would we be?
Well, if we didn't have these recyclers that are breaking down dead trees, if we didn't have recyclers that are breaking down dead animals, pretty soon we would be up to our armpits in dead animals. So we have to do something to decompose them and to recycle the nutrients. And insects are not the only player in this scenario, but they are often the first, and they are one of the important links.
Let's talk about dung beetles, because that's something else we don't want to be up to our armpits in.
Yeah, there are lots of dung beetles. And of course, when you Google dung beetle, you'll see the African dung beetles that are rolling these golf ball size pieces of dung away from the elephant pat. And what they're doing is they're collecting a food source into which they will lay an egg. And then the offspring, the larva, will eat that dung as its food supply. But that moves the dung off of the soil surface by these ones that we call rollers, the dung beetles that roll the dung away. They are burying it, getting it out of sight. And one of the success stories of this occurred in Australia when they started to put cattle on the Australian outback, and the dung didn't disappear. The manure just laid on the top. And they had to import dung beetles to help eliminate the dung off the soil surface. Of course, that reduces the number of flies that are out there. It adds fertility to the soil. And dung beetles are just cool on their own right.
So thinking about insects in this way, what should our takeaway be? Obviously, you have an incredible appreciation for insects, and you try to share that with other people. I mean, how should that change my behavior when I go outside or try to control the insects around my home?
You mean everybody doesn't have this enthusiasm for insects?
You haven't noticed it yet.
I haven't noticed. I thought everybody was pleased at the observation of wasps bringing back caterpillars and chopping it up as a food source. I thought everybody was admired the ability of the cicada killer wasp to find a cicada up in the tree and come back to a hole that she dug with her front feet in the ground. Just this admiration for what they're able to do really does shape a lot of how we view the world around us and go out and look at it.
All right. Well, Donald Lewis, we're going to take a short break. Entomologist Donald Lewis is here with us today. He will answer your insect questions in a moment. Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, will answer your plant questions. And you are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension Entomologist and Professor of Entomology, Donald Lewis. Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Duran is also here with us now. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here, and I'm starting to see trees burst into bloom. It's pretty exciting.
Starting, yes. But things have slowed down quite a bit in the last week to 10 days. It's been kind of crawling along. It's been 40s, low 50s, kind of cloudy, kind of rainy. So things are progressing, but kind of slowly at this point, which is good.
Right. I was going to say, we talked about that last week. Mm-hmm. This is a positive sign. Mm-hmm. We don't want it to go too fast and get a normal freeze. That takes it all out. So we'll enjoy those first flowers cautiously. Is that a good plan?
Yep. Good plan.
We are ready to take your calls, your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Josh is on the line in Tama. Hi, Josh.
Hello?
Hi, what's your question?
Say, I am 27 years old, and I remember growing up walking through the woods, rolling over logs, leaf litter, and seeing thousands of the nine-spotted lady beetle. And more recently now, I've noticed that it's a rarer occurrence. I'm just wondering if a standard pollinator mix would help, or is it the leaf litter and the logs that they're looking for, or are they just being outcompeted by the Asian beetle? And I had a second part question. At what point do invasive species, either insects or plants, become the new natives in an area? And with that, I will take my comment off the air.
All right. Thanks a lot, Josh.
Wow. That's a lot of questions. I think we need a graduate student who's finishing their ecology PhD to answer those questions for us. I'll take the first one. Nine-spotted lady beetle is a predator, and it's the one that's frequently either orange, it's pink or orange in color. And the accumulations that he's talking about was a wintertime phenomenon. By summer, the lady beetles have dispersed from these congregations, these aggregations, these clusters that were in sheltered locations. And in the summertime, they would be up in the trees. I agree with the observation that we're seeing fewer lady beetles than we used to. And the allegation is, as Josh mentioned, it's the multicolored Asian lady beetle, the largest ladybug of our group right at the moment, that has pushed out and outcompeted some of the other species, so that we're seeing more of that one and less of the fewer. A good resource for learning more about this particular topic is the Lost Ladybug Project. The Lost Ladybug Project is a citizen science project that is asking citizens around the country to report what ladybugs they find and when, and then they create these distribution maps. But the Lost Ladybug Project has actually documented that some of the things we used to think had gone extinct are still out there. They're just out there in very low numbers. Now, when does an invasive become native? I don't know. There's a time when we begin to accept them. The European corn borer was an invasive species back in the 1940s, and now we just think of it as part of the Iowa landscape. Some other things like the honeysuckle aphid that came in the 1990s, we now just accept as part of the landscape. We don't think about them as invasive anymore. The honeybee was invasive back in the 1400s when the colonists brought it to the United States, and now we think of it as part of our ecosystem. Richard, do invasive plants ever become established enough to be called native?
Good question. And I can't answer that. I don't know.
So,
They certainly become
naturalized.
A part of our landscape,
right.
Something that that doesn't look strange to us.
Right.
But I think once you have the word invasive added to you, such as the European colonists who arrived in the United States long ago, you kind of stay, that term stays with you for the rest of your life, even if you do become naturalized.
All right. Randy's up next in Iowa County. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. Is there any workshops around for people that are interested in your topics that they can come and possibly learn what kind of plants or non-disturbed ground that might help for different kinds of pollinators before springtime gets too far into gear?
There are lots of workshops and meetings. I don't have a full list off my head, but one of the places to check is with your local county extension office to see what the Iowa Master Gardeners are doing in your area or in the surrounding counties. Many of those meetings are more late winter, because master gardeners want to be in their gardens by this time of the year. So back in January, February, and March, there were meetings in Cedar Rapids and Mount Pleasant and Clinton and Burlington, places that I have been recently. So master gardeners would be one place to look for. There's an Iowa Prairie Network that does a lot of education about reestablishing prairies and plant identification, and they often offer field trips during the summer out onto the prairies. So look up the Iowa Prairie Network as well. The other one that comes to mind is the Iowa Honey Producers Association. They teach beekeeping classes over winter, but they're also interested in bee pasture. And so establishing areas that'll be good for honeybees, finding areas that'll be good for honeybees is one of their thing. Who else comes to mind to you, Richard?
Maybe their local county conservation board, possibly, because they might have some seminars or workshops too.
Natural Resource Conservation Service has information on planting various varieties for prairie establishment, for pollinator habitat establishment. So yes, your local county conservation board and the Natural Resource Conservation Service.
And if you're looking around, say, online for information about plants that would be beneficial to pollinators, because there's a lot out there right now, should you be careful to try to make sure that you're getting something from your region?
This is an ongoing argument, and we haven't settled it yet, and I think the sides are far enough apart that we probably won't. There are purists, often prairie enthusiasts, who think plants should not be moved more than 50 miles, that they'll sort of set this boundary and say, we want locally sourced plant material to establish our prairie. We want seed that came from nearby if we're establishing a new prairie. So there are people who will argue very adamantly that local sources are by far the best. But as we look around, sometimes we want things that aren't locally sourced. And so we do bring in things from other states. We bring them in from southern regions. We try to get northern grown plants if we can. So this is quite a controversy on what you should be buying and planting and establishing in your garden.
Well, and speaking of controversy, there's a fairly big controversy right now. Cheerios was trying to do their part for the pollinators and sending out packets of seed, wildflower seed. And what they sent out, over a billion?
It was a huge number, and it went out very quickly that they were using their Honey Nut Cheerios as an example of, here's where we use honeybees, we want to do our part to help. And so they sent out seed packets, and it justifies a phrase that I have carried in my mind for a long time, and that is, every good deed goes punished. And they were trying to do something good, and they got criticized for it. The other notion I carry in my mind is, we should not make it hard for people to do good things. And so this immediate criticism of the source is not good enough just seems like, gee, we're punishing people for trying to do good, and shouldn't we encourage them and try to educate them to do it a little better than they did it the last time? So I fall somewhere in the middle of that particular controversy, which I think is probably where I am in most of these controversies.
Just stay away from introduced invasive plants like purple loosestrife. That's a good point.
Don't plant purple loosestrife for the bees.
Exactly.
Terrible idea.
We used to. We used to plant a bunch of things that we no longer want in our landscapes.
And we've learned that lesson the very hard way. All right, 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a horticulture question for you, Richard. Jeff is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I just have a question about the asparagus. With it coming into season soon, when is the time to clear off the old patch? I mean, and like, should I burn it or mow it off or what?
I would prefer to cut it off, and I would do it this weekend if you can. So as soon as possible.
Okay, and does that also go for rhubarb, or is it too late for the rhubarb area?
Clean that up too as soon as you can, because my guess is it may already be up, so be very careful.
Yeah, my asparagus is up. It's only about 3 to 4 inches tall, but it came along pretty quickly and earlier.
All right. We're back to another insect question. Pat is on the line in Manchester. Hi, Pat.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Good. What's your question?
My question is in regards to box elder bugs. We have an older home, and we have had box elder bugs on the exterior every fall. Mm-hmm. This year, they've moved inside, and they just never went away. They've become quite a problem, and I'm wondering if there's any way that we can get rid of them.
Not easily. Box elder bugs live on the trees during the summer. They prefer maples, which would include the box elder tree, but other species of plants as well. They have 2 generations per summer, which means the few that make it through the winter get 2 chances to multiply by the fall when they're going to have to go back into hibernation. The weather during those times of reproduction determines how many we get, and some years we get a lot of box elder bugs, and some years we get fewer. It always varies from year to year, and it also varies from place to place. In the fall of the year, the adult box elder bugs seek sheltered locations where they're going to attempt to hibernate. And a house that is high on a hilltop, out in the open, the exposed silhouette, we call it, is highly attractive to box elder bugs throughout the county. So they come and land on your house, and when the sun goes down, a few of them crawl up under the siding, or they crawl in that gap between the foundation and the siding, or they climb up under the eaves, and a few of them get inside, which is not a good thing, because they should have stayed outside where they would be cold all winter. No box elder bugs reproduce during the winter. The ones you have in your house through the winter all got in last October. And they hid in the wall voids and in the attics, and a few of them come out every day. The practical solution during the winter is to vacuum them up or throw them back outside. In the summertime, if you wanted to spray the outside of your house in September, you might reduce the number on the outside. But spraying inside is not very useful.
Okay, okay. So what would you recommend spraying on the outside with? Because I'm not talking just about a couple dozen box elder bugs. I'm talking about a lot of box elder bugs.
Yep, and I can picture that from my youth. We had a house that fit my definition of a large house up on a hilltop out in the open. And it was the south side of the house would be black and red by the middle of October. The garden insecticides that we use, such as 7 and permethrin, will work moderately well for this. Because you're spraying so high up on the side of a two-story house, I would almost consider hiring a professional to do this instead. Talk to a pest control operator in the summer, see if they have a method to have the equipment to spray high on the house safely and effectively during the fall of the year when the box elder bugs are moving.
So what do box elder bugs do in our environment?
Well, they are sap feeders. They are true bugs in the order Hemiptera. And that immediately made you think of simple life cycle. All true bugs have a simple life cycle of egg, nymph, and adult. And you also thought of a small beak with which they feed on plant sap. And box elder bugs through the summer, especially the immatures, feed on sap either through green stems or small leaflets or the seeds, the developing seeds of maples and box elders and some other trees. So they feed on sap. Not that we ever notice that. They're up in the trees. We never notice that. It's not until this migration to hibernation site in the fall of the year that we even pay attention to them.
If they are getting into your house, is there any way to try to find the cracks that they get in through, or are they just so minuscule that that's a losing battle?
I wouldn't call it a losing battle, but it's not going to be perfectly successful either. Remember, box elder bugs on the side of your house have nowhere to go and all day to get there. And so they're just going to keep crawling around, and they're going to find cracks and gaps that we didn't even imagine. Certainly, if there's any sealing that can be done around windows, new caulking between the foundation and the siding, better fitting soffits, better fitting screens, all of those things will help. But none of them are going to be perfect. And we know that from brand new houses that are built to the highest energy efficiency standards. These are houses that are sealed up as tight as construction workers can make them, and they still get accidental invaders inside. So yes, we can help, but we can't keep them all out forever.
All right. Here's a question for you, Richard, from Fran. When is the right time to apply dormant oil spray on pruned apple trees? And when is the best time to spread crabgrass preventer fertilizer on the lawn in the Ames area? So first, apple trees.
You typically want to apply that before bud break. And that's getting real close at this time. It might be actually a little bit late on that. But I will say the dormant oil spray probably isn't as critical as they may think, in that it doesn't control the insects that later damage the fruit. It does not do that. So it may not be that critical. As far as putting on the pre-emergent in central Iowa, I'd be shooting for around April 15th this year.
All right. Here's a question from Jesse in Norwalk. I have a redbud sapling I'd like to move. Any tips on making that move successful?
I would do it as soon as possible, as soon as the ground is workable, maybe too wet, but do it before it begins to leaf out, and try to dig up a nice ball of dirt with the root system. They have a really deep root system. They tend to, so they can be difficult to move.
Well, and we're getting really close to blossom season for redbud trees. Is this something that they just shouldn't think about doing right now at all?
No, I would try to do it next week if they can. I don't think they're going to be blooming for another 2 weeks or so. So if they can, later on next week.
All right. So you've got a little bit of time, mm-hmm. and maybe even a day or two to dry out the soil around the trees as well.
Right.
All right. Here's a question from Dave. I've rotated my chickens to a pasture area. I'd like to plant a fast-growing ground cover crop in their bare chicken run that they've pecked clean. I know they'll peck their run bare again, but I want something for a fast-growing cover crop when I rotate them back in. Do you have an idea?
Maybe annual ryegrass, mm-hmm. possibly.
All right, and maybe experiment with it a little bit. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes to answer more of your questions about the plants and insects you encounter. Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron and Iowa State University Extension Entomologist and Professor of Entomology at ISU, Donald Lewis. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron. They are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to the phones. Jeff is on the line in Ankeny. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I have an oak tree in my front yard, and it drops acorns, like most oak trees do. And I once didn't mow for a while, and I got some little seedlings. And I was able to successfully get them out of the ground. Mm-hmm. I put them in a pot. Mm-hmm. They made it the entire summer, and they made it through the winter. I buried the pot. They made it through the winter. Mm-hmm. And then I transferred them into I have 5 or 6 of them. I transfer them into larger pots. And my question is, how long can I keep them in those pots before I need to get them in the ground?
How tall are they right now?
By the end of the summer last year, they were probably getting close to 1.5 or 2 feet tall. They're kind of differing heights.
Okay. I think I would be inclined to plant them in the ground this year. You could move them up to a larger pot. But I think I'd put them in the ground. And what I would do is maybe put some hardware cloth around them so that predators can't get them like rabbits. And so if you know where you want to put them, I'd be inclined to plant them this spring if I could.
Okay, this spring?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So is that kind of, because I was able to successfully do it again this year and get some more. Is that about the height when they get 1.5 to 2 feet, get them in the ground?
Yeah, I think I would, just because the bigger they get, the more difficult they are to plant or transplant. So a 2-foot tree, it's a pretty nice little tree.
Okay.
Jeff, did you get red oaks or white oaks?
They're white.
Okay.
Wow.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot for your call. Good luck. I hope they do well. Let's go next to Greg in Mason City. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. My question is, last summer and last fall here, we had a tremendous amount of rain. In September, I believe we had 6+ inches of rain. And my yard has always been very nice. And we noticed last summer, last fall, and this spring especially, there are areas that are brown and dying, and they're not dormant. There's dirt there. Mm-hmm. But last fall, they were dead and dormant as well. The rest of the yard is doing well. It's just certain areas of the yard. How do we want to go about looking at taking care of this area, and what could have caused that?
Well, it may have been a combination of the weather possibly leading to some type of fungal disease, which may have damaged or destroyed the grass because all that moisture.
Sure, that makes sense because our neighbors have the same situation as well.
Okay. Yeah. So I think the way that I would proceed would be I think I'd go ahead and apply fertilizer and a pre-emergent herbicide to prevent crabgrass and see what happens. And then in late summer, I would reseed or overseed these bare areas or thin areas. And I'd be shooting for around, I would say, mid to late August as far as a seeding date. That's the best time to sow seed Usually when we sow seed in the spring, we tend to end up with far more weeds than grass plants. So that's why spring is not the best time to do that. So if you do it in late summer, very few weed seeds germinate. And once the grass comes up, then typically it has two ideal months to grow and get established. So I'd be shooting for basically mid to late August.
Great answers. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call, Greg. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Here's a question from Jordan. What can I do to organically control Colorado potato beetle? I'll be planting around 3/4 of an acre of potatoes this season.
That's a lot of potatoes. My first answer was going to be to pick them off by hand.
But probably not.
You know, I pictured that Jordan was planting a row of about 10 feet long. But no, a 3/4 acre plot isn't going to work that way. I think one of the effective organic treatments for Colorado potato beetle is Surround. It's an insecticide that is a clay product. It's called kaolin clay. And we spray that on the plant, and it coats it so that it looks like you're growing plants alongside a dusty gravel road. And what that does is it protects from the egg laying by the beetles, and it also protects from the larvae feeding as much as they could. It doesn't really kill them. It's more of a deterrent. But as an organic treatment, I would start there. I would also look for some other products such as neem to see if you can apply that early enough. Now, neem is a growth regulator. It's not going to kill the big beetles. It's not going to control the large larvae that are already half an inch long. But if you can find the Colorado potato beetles while they're still tiny, the larvae, that is, neem would be another insecticide you could use that would be considered organic. So I would start with those two and hope that you have rotated the potato patch away from where you had Colorado potato beetles the previous year.
Okay, that might be hard with that large a patch. Huh?
Well, it is, and unless you own a lot of land, it's hard to rotate. But that's one of the things that huge
helps.
Potato
right.
growers have learned is that if they can just move the potatoes 1/4 mile from where they were before, it helps reduce the first infestation of Colorado potato beetles and gives them a chance to establish the plants before they're ruined by the leaf feeders.
All right, here's a question from Chris in Denver. There are lots of houses and kits to make that are advertised in garden catalogs for mason bees. Do we have mason bees in Iowa, or will these houses be good protection for other beneficial insects?
Our experience with mason bees is that they are out there, and you can buy mason bees. You can add them to your orchard. You can add them to your garden. They're called either blue mason bees, or they may be called orchard bees. So these are available, but we already have them. Our experience, however, though, is if you just put up a bee house, as in a block of wood that has 3/8-inch holes drilled into it, or a tube into which you have put large paper soda straws, if you put that up in your garden, you may get a mason bee, but more likely you'll get spiders and wasps. So it's hard to help these mason bees.
These houses are really cute, Donald.
Oh, and it's like putting up a sign in your butterfly garden that the difference between my garden and a butterfly garden is the one has a sign that says butterflies are welcome here. And your bee house is an advertisement that I'm doing what I can, and it's an opening to talk to other people about mason bees.
So
and
if
others.
They're so cute that you can't resist, yeah, put one up.
Put one up. Don't expect a huge return on your investment. But
make it extra cute.
Make it extra cute. Paint it nicely. Weatherproof it. And when you get wasps and spiders, remember they are part of the natural ecosystem too.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Wayne is on the line in Tama. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning. We live on about 2.5 acres, and in the back corner we've got a lot of trees and shrubs. Nothing that's Anyway, we've got bare spots back there, and we want to put some trees or shrubs back there. And my daughter's been looking at a hybrid poplar called Populus deltoids by Populus nigra. Do you know anything about that one?
Well, hybrid poplars are very common. The nice thing is they grow very quickly. They're easy to grow. The drawback is they have a number of insect and disease problems, and so they tend to be fairly short-lived. So good points and bad points.
They live fast and die young.
Well, that was a thing, because I know I'm familiar with the old poplars that didn't live long and they broke, and the ads say that this is not true on these, but I just wondered if it was just advertising.
I think that may be an exaggeration somewhat, yes.
Yeah, it says they go 30 to 50 years.
Which yeah.
Which a little bit strange.
And they might make it to 30 years, but they're not going to be 50, 60, 75 years old, no.
All right, Wayne, thanks a lot for your call. Marlene sent us questions for each of you, so we'll start with her question for Richard. I recently repotted a shamrock plant and found small snail-like creatures about, well, maybe this one's for either one of you two. All right, small snail-like creatures about a quarter of an inch in diameter with a hard shell. Since I brought the plant in last fall, the leaves were jagged as if something had chewed on them. I removed as many of these as I could from the soil, but don't know if I got them all. Is there anything else I can do to prevent them from returning?
Snail control is not something that's easy to do. You could try slug bait. If this is a plant that you put outside for the summer, you could put a little slug bait to see if that controls the snail population. I like the mechanical control. I like the limitations. I also think this would be a place where you would carefully monitor watering and not do any more watering than is absolutely necessary.
Right. Not keep it too wet. Right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I know you're a hosta lover, Donald. She says, also, my hostas on the north side of my house appeared to be riddled with little holes last summer. Would that be insect damage? If so, what can I do?
Probably not insect damage, although there are some things like sow bugs and some earwigs that may feed on foliage. Those holes, those perforations through hosta leaves are more often the product of slug damage. And you've got a couple of options. You can go out at night when the slugs are feeding, look for them and pick them off by hand. You can put down traps, which are usually pie pans embedded in the soil, into which you put a little cheap beer. The slugs crawl over to the beer. They fall in and they die with a smile on their face. Or there are slug baits at the garden center. And we used to use metaldehyde, but the new organic treatment is iron phosphate. And that's been replaced with another ferrous material, another iron product. So look for slug baits at the garden center and apply them Memorial Day weekend. Don't wait until August to start controlling slugs. Get them when they're just starting their development at the end of May.
All right. Here's a question from Jessica. I have a clematis plant in my yard. This will be the third spring. My neighbor told me I should trim the growth close to the ground. Is my neighbor right?
It depends upon what type it is. Most of the types that we grow bloom on new growth. Things like Jackmanii, which is very common with the purple flowers. And so we can cut those back to within maybe 6 inches of the ground. There are some that we don't see too much that bloom on the previous year's growth. So you wouldn't want to do that to those because that would reduce the blooming. So it kind of you really have to know what kind it is, but most types in Iowa bloom on new growth. So you can cut them back to within a few inches of the ground.
Here's a question from Jess and Clive. I have flowers and shade plants that are covered by the dead, dried leaves from the plant last year, with little green buds popping up from underneath. My mom always cleared her plants off as soon as the rains start coming so they could, quote, soak up as much water as possible. Should I uncover them? Should I wait? If I should wait, when should I do it?
I would tend to clean it up. They can do so basically in late fall or very early spring. One benefit is if, for example, you have a foliar disease, for example, powdery mildew, and you get rid of that dead plant debris, that should reduce the severity of that disease for that coming year. So it's kind of nice to clean things up eventually.
All right. And here's one from Mark in Ames, and I'd love to hear your response briefly to this, Donald. He says, please address the indiscriminate use of insecticides such as Fogs. I just saw them on sale. I thought we were smarter than that. Or putting Seven Dust on the vegetable blossoms because there are bugs on them and killing all the pollinators that come to do their job. It's we need to and want to control the insects that are damaging the plants that we're trying to grow to eat. But are we still overdoing?
Oh, I think we are, but not to the extent that we used to. And Mark has hit the same message that I have been teaching for the last 40 years and my predecessor for 40 years before that, and that is to practice integrated pest management. look for alternatives when you can, use the least toxic material, use it only when it's absolutely necessary. And it's that necessary that becomes the hard thing to define, that if I expect perfect fruit, I'm going to think they are necessary, though I'm still never going to treat flowers in bloom. If our neighborhood is afraid of West Nile virus and mosquito bites, the city is going to fog for them. And there's no easy answer when you get these competing points of view on how much is too much and is any of it necessary. So somewhere in the middle, there's a good answer, and we're still looking for it.
Alfonso is on the line in Des Moines. Alfonso, what's your question?
Yes. Well, I'm 27, and I like the radio show and talks and like that. I like to listen to Science Friday and everything. But my question is, since bees are declining, and we're working on trying to repopulate them and make them grow more, if we don't, since we have automation and robotics and all that, we'll be able to do the same things as bee does? Can we build like small robots and do everything what bees pretty much do?
All right, so can humans do the work of the pollinators that we're in danger of losing?
This comes up quite a bit, and Alfonso is onto a topic that's called micro aviation vehicles, I think MAV, and the government and various companies have made these micro flying robots that we do have the ability to power little tiny gadgets that can fly around and be surveillance for us. They can detect landmines for us. That these little vehicles have a lot of applications. Anytime this comes up, the first argument is, wouldn't it have been better to save the bees we've got than try to replace them? Well, sure, but it's nice to know that there are investigations, there are research processes going on to see if there are some other alternatives. Of course, we can do manual pollination ourselves. If you had a tomato in a greenhouse, you could do the pollination yourself. If you're a fig grower in California, you're going to do pollination by humans. So there are lots of alternatives out here. Micro aviation vehicles is sort of a fascinating one, and it could come to that.
Because it is a really big, serious problem. I mean, the human species would encounter a lot of problems if we lost these pollinators.
Yes. We would still have corn. We would still eat soybeans. We would still have grains. But we would not have the rich variety of fruits and vegetables that we're used to. So that's why we need the pollinators. Keep them out there.
All right. Donald Lewis, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Entomology professor and ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Richard Duran, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist Richard Duran. We'll be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. The show is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. We had production assistance today from Chelsea Hoy. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa. Have a great weekend.